Welcome to Attended Exchange, the Wilford's Property Podcast. Each episode, we'll sit down with somebody in the design and property space and take a real deep dive into what makes them tick.
So Richard Atkins from Design Space London, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Thanks for coming to see us today. So Design Space London, one of London's most innovative companies, designing and installing sleek architectural kitchens. You're in now.
Well, I started in a sort of a similar family business. So I was working alongside my dad. That's how it all sort of began for me. And at the time I was actually thinking more about going into sort of a profession.
Were you? Which, what kind of profession? What
did you say? I was studying law at the time.
I didn't know that. Yeah. We've known each other for 25 years and I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I was studying law and I was working kind of in the summers to kind of pay for my holidays and my whatever in what was my dad's business with his partner.
And did you have an idea of what kind of speciality, what of law you wanted to go into?
Mostly into sort of litigation. I was quite into kind of, you know, having debates and that kind of thing, and so I was really quite interested in that. But
yeah,
I think sort of two things happened while I was going through that process. I think one, I got to meet some people who were doing that as a job and sort of see some of the realities of that, and say that they'd also got involved in my dad's business kind of over summers and that kind of thing and weekends, and actually kind of found that I was enjoying that a lot. So I got moved.
Sort of dragged that way,
yeah,
naturally.
It's a bit like a tide, sort of just pulled into it. I think my dad was probably apprehensive about me getting involved because, I think anything that you do yourself, you see the kind of the drawbacks of that profession, or, you know, as I think we probably both do in our own now. You know, I probably saw that I was interested in doing something else, so probably didn't want to influence that I sort of did one thing or another.
I heard Gordon Ramsay being interviewed on a podcast recently, and he was basically saying not to employ family members, basically, because obviously that in itself can bring with it some challenges. But obviously in this instance, it's worked out really well, because your dad, Keith, he just backpedaled for me. So your how did dad get into it? Am I right in saying he started importing kitchens from Italy in the 80s, 70s?
So to begin with, they imported kitchens from Germany. So they were the first importers of a product called Bortelt, which is a fairly well-known brand today.
Okay.
And that was part of another company where he worked for somebody else. I think, you know, again, sort of just naturally sort of went through that progression, met some people that he was quite excited about working with.
Right.
And ended up working with his partner, Lawrence. And they then did start to import Italian kitchens. So again, another brand that's still around today. They were sort of big advocators for sort of modern design. And that kind of was an influence on me growing up. So again, that I've always been around that, you know, sort of slightly artistic, but sort of design orientated and interested in how a house is formed and how things come together. So my dad and his partner had this business, and it was, you know, it was a fairly successful business in Battersea. They're importing a really nice product again. It's one that's still around today called Boffy. And
massive, right?
Yes, it's a big brand today. Again, they were the first importers of that into the UK, and really kind of helped to build that brand in the UK to, you know, to become what it has today. And so again, I probably didn't sort of understand that at the time.
No.
That I started working there. And again, I sort of started, you know, as I say, as a kind of a summer thing. So I was moved around the business. And I think as much as my dad wasn't looking for me to get involved in the business necessarily, I think he was quite keen that I understood how a business operated. So wanted me to see how the sort of stock and warehousing worked, how the accounts department worked, how, you know, the contracts department worked. So I had a fairly good sort of organic experience in that I got to sort of have a look at all those things, and on the job training, so I understood how invoices got filed.
You're actually a really young age, really. I mean, you're in your early 20s, right?
I was 18, I think, the same time. Okay. Sort of end of studying A levels when I started sort of getting involved in his business, right.
And you've been working there full time pretty much since,
not long after that. I think we kind of had a conversation where, you know, I was looking at what I would do next, and you at the time I think you feel like whatever you do then is going to be forever, and that, you know, I think as you get older, you realise actually there are opportunities to change course. But I think at that point, I felt like whether I turned left or right was kind of a defining moment. So I gave it a go and sort of put that into full time, and then sort of carried on that same kind of on the job training. Really, I kind of moved around the various departments. So I got involved in running the warehouse to begin with. Again, I think my dad at the time was employing, you know, 10 or 11 people and didn't want them to see that, you know, I was sort of being moved into a certain position. So I started right at the bottom.
Brilliant.
I'm sort of really grateful for that, because I really do understand now when I'm employing someone to do any job within my business,
get it, you've done it.
What they have to do.
Yeah.
Some of those jobs were incredibly enjoyable. Again, I think as you kind of move through a business, very much, I'd say, you know, you run your own business, you end up doing less of the job and more of running a business. So, you know, you end up doing HR, accounting, PR, a little bit of everything. And, you know, the thing that I really love about my job is the artistic side of it and the design side of meeting people and that kind of thing. And actually, you get to do a bit less of that as you sort of progress through a company, because there's certain things that only you can do, which is one of the sort of frustrating elements about running a business.
Yeah, I'm experiencing that as we grow now.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And so,
but at the core of it, that's your passion, the design element of it, meeting the clients, obviously making the clients happy, and then seeing the end product.
Yeah, I think it's also understanding the sort of the different types of business that you're working in. So as you say, that meeting the clients can mean a number of things in what we do, because it can be somebody's own home and you're meeting them, so meeting a family, you know, and working out.
What's the split between big developers, and you deal with some of the biggest developers in central London and wider, and obviously some of the sort of boutique development schemes, like, you know, you and I met obviously when we bought our first flat. You bought the flat beneath my flat on the ground floor, I bought my flat on the first floor. You and your wife, Nick, I can remember walking into your flat, because it was the footplate was pretty much identical, right? Because I was the first floor, you were the flat directly beneath me. And I remember walking into your flat for the first time thinking, wow, this looks amazing. After you'd obviously done the kitchen, the bathroom, the wardrobes.
Yeah.
And I was still there with my sort of 1980s IKEA kitchen and still needed to sell a lot more houses. I think I was working at Foxes at the time. You know, you gave me a lot of design inspiration. But then across the road, there's Audiology House, which you worked on, which is a really great boutique development in SW12 Clapham South. What's the split, going back to my question, what's the split between sort of working on developers and working on private residences, roughly?
In terms of sort of number of kitchens, we probably do more development kitchens, but that's just because there can be huge numbers involved in some of the ones that we do now, so they can run into hundreds. So doing that many private houses would just be time prohibitive, you know, be very difficult, because there's a lot of repetition in the developments. You know, you can rack up bigger numbers of things, but in terms
The biggest developments with regards to like unit numbers, what's that sort of coming in at?
So the biggest projects, so the biggest project we worked on is a project over in Dublin, actually, for 500 apartments. So we do a fairly big range of developments. So a project of 500 is going to have a slightly different specification to some of the sort of, as you say, the sort of boutique developments.
So near our Kensington office, I think you've worked on Lancer Square, just at the end on Kensington Church Street. How many units are in there, roughly?
36 in there. So we did kitchens and wardrobes there. And again, for us, that's a really nice
number.
It's sort of mid-scale development. So it's, you know, there's still a lot of design that goes into that. You know, there's a lot of time that goes into it.
And that, I mean, they're retailing like £4,000-£5,000 a square foot. They're really high spec, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's sort of a project a year that we work on like that. So in that year we worked on Lancer Square. The year prior we worked on a project in Marylebone High Street, which is a very similar kind of project, which was an old cinema building that had been developed into 19 apartments and 5 townhouses. And this year we're working on a project of a similar scale for 28 apartments in Carrington Street in Mayfair. Right. So again, those are really interesting developments to work on, because there's still an awful lot of design that goes into them.
And that's the bit you leap out of bed in the morning and get excited about still.
Absolutely. Again, I think that it's we were talking about it earlier, it's the period that you work on those projects can be a number of years, so it's less sort of design led at all points than you might think. Some points it's very much a kind of a pricing exercise and working through sort of logistics with contractors and that kind of thing.
We were just chatting about this, weren't we, before we actually came in and sat down in front of the camera and the microphones. We were just chatting about, you know, pitching for business.
Yeah.
And how much
Yeah,
how much energy do you put into that when, I guess, you know, similar to, well, similar and not, but to an estate agent, you know, we do the beauty parade where if someone's thinking of selling their house, they probably get three agents through the door. Obviously, you've got to do your pitch. We sit down, we do that preparation work, we do our research, you know, we go in there, we invest time and energy. But on the size and scale of some of the businesses that you're doing and pitching, some of the size of the developments that you're pitching, you could invest days, if not weeks, right?
It'd be weeks of time before between sort of the first contact for that kind of project and being awarded. And then by the time the building's built, in some of the projects I look back on, and it can be 7 years between sort of first contact and we're no longer working and, you know, we've completed. So, yeah, it's a long... it's a long time period. You're not, say, you're certainly not in there for a short-term gain. But if you put enough irons in the fire, it's like a lot of things, you know, we look at sort of maybe 10 of those kind of projects a year, ranging from sort of really big ones to medium-sized developments. And, you know, two or three of them will be successful with.
That's all you need, right? Because of the size of scale.
It is. And say that...
Keeps you out of mischief for a
while. It does. It does keep you out of mischief for a while. Say... you know, you say at some point your client is a different person as well. So at the beginning, your client is the developer, the architect, and you're very much looking at it from a kind of a cost advice and design advice point of view. Later on, the person that pays you is a contractor, so effectively a builder. And so their ambitions are slightly different. They want to make sure you can do it on time, you know, on budget, that you've got resources. Yeah. So their sort of questions of you and requirements of you are quite different to the person's requirements at the beginning. The developer's requirements are, you know, do you have a product that's going to help me to sell this development? And is that product going to be aspirational for the person that walks through the door? And once it is, can it be at a price that I can afford to pay? So, and it's a similar kind of aspiration for the architect. Their aspiration is that their vision of this kind of interior is, you know, our small part of it is... It feeds into that overall vision. So I think
that's great, but you can lean on your 2+ decades of experience, isn't it? Because it's very much needed by the sounds of things.
It is. Say there's you know, the market moves. So sometimes you start with one thing and you need to look at ways of saving money or updating a design. There's obviously lots of things that change with regulation as you go through, and so sort of fire regulations, building regulations. So you need to have knowledge of all of those things. So an architect typically has got some of that knowledge, but they rely on specialists for each part of it. So they'll have the same with lighting, with kitchens, with, you know, mechanical engineering, so plumbing and, you know, that type of thing. And you know, they need a sort of a good supply chain or sort of resource book of suppliers that they can call on. And that's very much kind of our domain when we do that we need to be seen to be a reliable kind of source of information at some point. So again, very much at that point, you're not going to be selling anything that day. You know, your sale will come further down the line, but you're there as a sort of a sounding block, you know, for advice with a view to getting more involved.
Yeah, it's a long game, isn't it?
It is a long game, yeah. So for individual houses, it's very different. You're talking to individuals and it's their home, so it's a completely different skill set.
Well, you helped Susan and I with our house in Wandsworth Common, and I've obviously known you for a long time, and you've helped me before with, you know, previous flats. And I said to my wife, you know, we'll go and see Rick. Obviously, you know, you and Nick are very close friends of Susan and I, and Rick will give us some advice. And we came into Wigmore Street and we said, and you went, right, if I were you, I would do this. And and then, because Suze hadn't really done it before, she then went off and spent a bit of time looking at and investing on, you know, the options and all the rest of it. And I knew what would happen, and you probably did too, but we ended up circling all the way back down to, or she did, circling all the way back around to exactly what you advised us on day one.
Yeah.
Which I just think is real testament to your experience, knowing us as you do. It's just quite fun.
I think that's probably part, the better you know people, the easier it becomes. Yeah. And really, that's our job, is to extract somebody's taste from them. Because if we just did the same thing for everybody, there's not a right and wrong answer. There's not a way of doing it. But what you're trying to
it's
do
really
is...
It's subjective, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. But what you're trying to do is extract from somebody what their taste is and then mix that with your advice. And so that really is the job when it comes to sort of somebody's individual house. It's trying to work out sort of visually... you know, ergonomically, sometimes how they use the kitchen, so isn't there much point at all designing something for someone that sort of looks great but really isn't going to work for them. You know, you have to go for that thing. It can be, you know, you spend a lot of time in the kitchen. You'll use it every day. It's just to some extent. If you go out for dinner, you're going to make a coffee. You're going to do something. So that those processes that you do every day need to be simple. And you know, when you unload the dishwasher, there's all those sort of boring things. But yeah, there has to be a photo. So cool. But all of those things become irritating if you get it wrong. Right.
Yeah. Going back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. What was teenage Richard like?
I think probably a lot like most teenage boys. I'd get myself into trouble. I'd, you know, I'd spent a lot of time outside with friends, you know, playing sports and that kind of thing.
You're annoyingly good at sport.
I dedicate a lot of time to sport. I love sport. It's, it's kind of, for me, that's again, outside of work, it's probably my...
You're very good at everything sport-wise. Literally skiing, running, tennis...
I'm not that good at any of them. The good thing
I'm
is
just really bad.
I think the thing is, I've always wanted.
I look like Boris, but I don't play like him. That's the problem.
You certainly look like him. Is that thing of sort of wanting to be able to do everything. So again, I'm not an expert at any of those things, but I can. If someone says, "Do you want to have a game of tennis?"
Yeah,
you know, I can have a game of tennis.
And you're really into fitness at the moment, aren't you? You've been doing some stuff. With
I'm running the cycle
and
quite a bit.
What did you do recently? What was it? It wasn't a Tough Mudder. It was similar.
Spartan.
Is that the next level up above, or similar?
Very similar thing. Okay. I think you say it just happened. It was a chance to go away together with some mates for a weekend. They're all interested in the same kind of thing. Yeah, very much so. Again, I think we've all kind of got to that age where. Probably slightly different to our parents.
You're a bit younger than me, aren't you? You're
43,
okay.
So you start to realise that, you know, it will be beneficial to kind of be active for as long as you can be and, you know, to sort of enjoy this other phase of life. So again, a lot of my friends that we're doing that thing with sort of between 40 and 50, say.
Right.
So I think it's that thing where, you know, you're not old, but, you've got that sort of, thing on the horizon suddenly.
Yeah, you know, the next milestone is actually 50. Yeah, actually, when you're young, I remember getting my hair cut quite a few years ago, and, you know, going to the barbershops, hairdressers, whatever, and there was a bloke's magazine there, and it was like, Brad Pitt's going to turn 40. And I remember thinking, like, fucking hell, that's old. And then, similar sort of thing, obviously, a decade later, Brad Pitt's going to turn 50. And I'm thinking, wow, that's old. But as I now approach 50, I'm thinking, it's not that old.
No, I think as you get older, you have to start convincing yourself that different ages are not
that
old.
Exactly, yeah.
I think that, as I say, the fitness thing kind of feeds into that. I think it's just about being able to... I don't want to sort of dedicate enough time to any one thing that I become really good at that one thing. I just care more about, you know, that I can go and have a game of tennis with a friend or a game of golf if it's a game of golf, or if someone wants to go take a bike out and have a cycle, I can do that. And so, the fitness thing kind of feeds into that, really.
You've sort of answered it, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Who's your typical client?
It's difficult, actually, and it's really changed over, the last 10 years. I'd say 10 or 15 years. I'd say 10 or 15 years ago, most of our clients were, for individual houses anyway, right. were kind of in... professions, so kind of bankers, lawyers, you know, accountants and that type of thing. There's a lot more entrepreneurial clients now, I would say.
Okay,
so our spread of clients are probably a lot bigger. I think, you know, a lot of people that have sort of bought and sold companies, a lot of people that are, you know, that head companies, lots of people that are in sort of sports and television.
So quite a few high profile. Obviously, they're all reasonably high net worth to be able to afford the sorts of properties that we're talking about, and therefore the product finish that you are providing.
Yeah, again, I think we're very well known for, as you say, kind of higher design and that type of thing. You know, but not everything we do has to be exactly like that. Again, it's one thing I'm trying to really kind of reinforce with the people that work with us that, you know, London actually as an area is huge now. Mm. And actually, if you look at, as I say, feeds into kind of what you do is sort of property values. As you start to sort of move out of really central London, actually, properties that are even sort of on the edge of London and the surrounding areas can sort of justify something that's worth sitting down and designing. And actually, so I'm really keen to kind of reinforce to, say, people that work with us, people that we talk to, that I really don't like the idea that it's kind of a, you know, West 1, SW7 kind of, you know, ish thing. I think, you know, what we do is translatable across, you know.
And how far do you go geographically? What makes sense? I mean, apart from sort of, you know, you, I know you've got a place in Wales, for example, but if you were, what's the furthest you've done for a client who you don't know?
Oh, so we worked all over the world for...
Have you really?
Yeah, so we've just recently finished a project in Oman. We've done projects in... Yeah, so we work...
You're so modest, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, we work anywhere. Anywhere there's a project that sort of justifies, you know, us doing it. So, yeah, in terms of certainly nationally, we actually, again, a bit like we're saying, sort of change of clients. I think geographic changes have happened. A lot of people, especially over kind of the last few years where, you know, I think a lot of people reassessed over kind of the whole COVID thing and people moved out of London. We've done a lot of houses kind of outside of London, I think.
And just jumping back to the Oman development, how did that materialise? Where did that come from? Is that a developer who'd used you in London and then he or she had relocated over there?
No, it was an architect that basically was working on a project. I think getting the kind of products that we do to those areas actually isn't quite as easy as you think. So some of them, if they don't have dealers for particular products or, you know, Italian products there, a lot of them, the architect or the professional team are in London. And so actually working on the design and everything, which is where most of the time's spent, is just as easy to do here. And then, say, shipping the goods in that particular project, the goods were taken down to Venice, put on a container, sent to Oman, and then we flew the team out there to install.
You did? Okay. Yeah. And did you have to go over to Oman? Did you need to go to Oman initially?
The team that worked on the design did. Yeah, okay. So they'll go there. Not to price. So you price everything from drawings, but in terms of kind of then just making sure the space is ready. Again, if you're going to send a team and all those goods there, what you wouldn't want to do is go and find that the room was a different size or things weren't ready for you and that type of thing. So we send people out there to have a look and just sort of, you know, pre-assess what's happening.
And team-wise, how many guys and girls do you work with, employ at Design Space London?
So employed every day, we've got 12 people that work with us. And then we employ a sort of a wider team of installers, delivery people that work for us nearly all the time. So again, we've got two stone companies that we deal with. We'd make up a fairly big proportion of their business. But then installers typically work for us every day. You need to sort of be able to control their diaries to give the right kind of service. So that all falls under our umbrella, but they're just not employed by us every day. Not the full width of the team.
So we probably scale up and scale back.
Yeah, we need to be able to scale up and scale back. So we can employ anywhere between kind of 20 and 30 people, I would say, depending on, say, if we've got a project for 500 kitchens running, we'll have 10 installers just doing that one project. So.
Right. I'm going to jump around between you and your profession and also you and your private life, personal life. If there's any questions that you're not comfortable answering, then obviously just, you know, we can sort that out. But so how long have you and your beautiful wife, Nick, been married for?
25 years next year, so 24 years.
Wow. How did you guys meet?
We met through friends. So Nicola was at university. I went down to see her, some friends of hers, and we met then, but we sort of just became friends for a while. Nicola ended up moving to London to carry on with her master's degree.
She's from Swansea, isn't she?
She's from Swansea, so she was, she was at university in Bristol. So we met there. She moved up to London.
And so you were studying law?
I was studying law.
What was she studying?
Linguistics and psychology. Sense. She's finished that and she's still studying now. She loves just expanding what she's doing in that field. And so, as we were saying earlier, you know, our children are now kind of getting into teenage high school years. So I think the next sort of phase of her career is sort of taking off.
My sister did a similar thing, actually, because my niece and nephew, once they went to secondary school, I think my sister then felt, now that they're not little anymore, they don't need quite as much time and dedication. She actually retrained.
Yeah.
I think that's quite common, isn't it?
I think it's an exciting part of you know, your life when you've sort of got the confidence to do it. You feel like you've got a bit more time, and I think it's a really good time to start a career. I think it's, you know, aside from that, I think it's probably more likely actually for our children that they're going to have to be a bit adaptable and that careers will change a little bit more frequently than perhaps we've been lucky enough to work in sort of a similar industry for, you know, best part of our work in life. That might not be something that's available to everybody going forward. So I think...
So you've got three beautiful children, Finn, Molly and Lucas. What are their passions?
They're all very different. So
they're really different. Yeah,
very, very, very different children. So they look very different. They all got their own interests. So I'll say Finn's 15. I think he's very entrepreneurial, very sporty, but he also is very interested in kind of the way that things work. So he, you know, he always wants to know, if I buy something for this, can I sell it for that? You know, he's always looking for avenues. He's got that kind of
bit of a tell boy, wheeler dealer.
I think he's got that sort of inquisitive nature. Absolutely. You can have him. I don't know how long you'd keep him for. He's into that. He's very much into his sports as well. Again, I think all of our family like being outside. Yeah. So it's whether it's sports as kind of a conventional sport or sort of sailing, surfing, that kind of thing. I think the thing we've got in common is that we all love being outdoors.
Molly's really creative, isn't she?
Very, very creative. So again, much more aligned with kind of interest in our industry and, you know, how that might feed into what she's doing.
That's
so
interesting.
She's very much into art. I think that kind of feeds into interiors, and she's also quite into sort of psychology. And actually, there is a psychological element to what, you know, whether you're selling or designing, there's a psychological element to what we do. So she's very much into art, drama, psychology, that type of thing. She's a 13-year-old.
And Lukey?
Lucas is into it. Loves his food. Lucas, since he's been, you know, 7 or 8, you'd come down and you could smell eggs and bacon going, and the gas is going.
Does he end up working in the kitchen?
He likes being in the kitchen. He likes eating what's been made in the kitchen. So he's a very independent guy. I think, say third child, you kind of
end up like that. Older siblings.
Older siblings.
Mature for his age.
And
so confident. Brilliant. Well, they're all brilliant.
Yeah.
So what advice would you give? Because obviously we're now, mid to late 40s. What would you... I was on LinkedIn yesterday, and there was a younger real estate agent who's doing really well. I think he's kind of, he's working for one of the sort of newer agencies who have got consultants working for them. So he's set up his own business underneath an umbrella of a bigger sort of agency brand. And he's got a young... I think just one son or daughter, like baby age, toddler age. And he's really struggling to sort of find the balance between working, being a present dad, being a decent husband, and doing the job that we do. And I'm sure it's the same for you. I'm sure it's the same for most people in this day and age. You know, with the phones that we've got, you're kind of contactable 24/7. I know that you've become a lot better over the years at managing the stresses and the strains.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to somebody who's sort of 10, 15 years younger than us that's starting out, not starting out, but at that level in their career with regards to trying to manage all of that that life throws at you?
I think just being present in what you're doing at that time. So again, I used to spend an awful lot of time worrying about things that I probably couldn't influence at that particular time.
Right.
And actually what I've done now is I've really stopped doing that. I really focus on problem solving when I need to solve that problem, and I try really to give it very little thought other than that.
Right.
Because I think...
Have you gone to the lengths of having like a digital clock on your desk, which Musk or whatever sort of talks about? I'm going to devote half an hour to this, 30 minutes, go.
I think it's good to start your day with some form of a structure about what you want to achieve in that day. I think in our line of work, it's probably fairly similar with yours. There are fairly serious curveballs that can be thrown at you halfway through the day. And sometimes you have to accept that the plan gets torn up and that you're going to do something different. And that happens. And I think it's important not to get too pent up about that. You know, sometimes those things happen. Like I said about that thing of control, if you can't control that, if something's come up that really needs your time at that point, then roll with it and don't let it kind of consume you. Don't waste energy on worrying about things that you can't influence or control.
In your professional career, what's been your biggest success?
I'd say really the team that I've kind of generated around me. I think that's the thing is that I've learned that sort of goes back to the last question a little bit, that I love working hard, and I think probably the thing that I used to do too much is try to do everything. And it's a difficult thing when you're so involved in what you do and you're passionate about it and proud about it that you renege and let go and sort of give some control to other people. And finding a team of people that you can really trust and rely on, I think, is probably the thing that's, one, it's most important, and two, it's the thing I'm most proud that I've succeeded in doing. I've got some people around me now that I really trust and enjoy working with. And I think that's kind of the biggest testament you can sort of leaving a business is that, you know, it doesn't rely on you solely, you know, that the people around you are capable.
What's the average length of term, you think, of the guys and girls that are working with you?
Most of the people that work there have worked with us for sort of 7, 8, 10, 15 years. It's, you know, we really don't have a...
Which is testament to you guys, because obviously they enjoy working there. Right.
Yeah, I hope so. I think it's sort of, we certainly try to look after the people that work there. They are the kind of the reason the business is successful. And I think that's
a pretty cool boss.
I hope so. Trying to stay out of their way.
Who do you perceive to be your biggest competitor, and what do you admire most about their work?
I would say there's sort of one other sort of big competitor. I admire anyone that's doing a similar thing to what we're doing, that as in that they're still an independent rather than
having sold out to the big
corporates. Having sold out to sort of big corporates, or let a manufacturer take control of their business. So right. Very much like what you're doing, you're in control of your own destiny. You live and die by the decisions that you make, and that you make with your team, and there's nobody kind of controlling what you do. And so there's two or three other companies that operate in a similar kind of space to us, and I mean that in terms of sort of the market and locality.
And there's a respect there, because you know...
There is, I know what goes into it, absolutely. Yeah. So again, I have a huge amount of respect for what they do, because I know how hard it is to make things work. And
favourite holiday?
That's a tough one.
Just come back from the Caribbean?
Just come back from the Caribbean, so yes, that's a great
holiday. Wales or the Caribbean?
I'd have to go with Caribbean as a holiday. Wales is more like a home from home, so we have a house in
Wales.
We love being there, and you know, so that gives us an opportunity to do all the things we like doing outside. So sailing, surfing, walking, running, cycling, all that stuff. Caribbean is really a kind of a, as much as I don't ever sort of sit down on the beach, but you can still do all those things there, but it's a bit more relaxing, and it's kind of, you know, weather's warmer obviously and that type of thing. We're all big skiers as well, so you know, skiing would be another one.
Yeah, you're a very good skier actually. You're the only person on my stag do who managed to keep up with Guy Gittings on the
stage. I didn't go. I've got a video of me falling down a mountain behind Guy Gittings.
he's an
incredible skier.
What does your 5-year plan look like, if you've got one?
Yeah, I think I sort of have. Again, as I said, our children are in their teens. So again, I think my plan is to continue as we are, probably to give a bit more space to Nicola to allow her to kind of grow her career over the next 5 years.
She's a speech therapist, right?
She's a speech therapist, yes. So she's just taking on a research project at City University. So again, hopefully that sort of leads somewhere for her. I think I'm quite content in what I'm doing, and I think I'm still very passionate about it, and I don't know about growing the business. We've looked at other cities in the UK to kind of expand into recently, or looking
at... That gives you a few more sleepless nights, wouldn't it?
It would, isn't it? But I think it's that thing about once you've got that structure, a bit like we were saying earlier about if you kind of increase the number of staff, the things that are hard actually are getting to where you've got a structure in place and all those things sort of operate, not on their own, but the hard work is in setting them up. So I think just replicating that for another location, I think the difficult things are finding what drives that market, because it will be a bit different to London. So you look at other cities where the type of thing we're doing could operate, you know, it'd be Manchester, it might be Edinburgh, that type of thing. You've got some things of time and distance then, so in terms of how much time you can spend in that location and how much influence you can exert on that being successful. But that's something that I'm kind of keen to look at.
So explore a bit further. Yeah, I think when we set our business up, someone said to me, when you first start a business from concept, it's like trying to get a juggernaut moving. Mm. And those first few years, I mean, they were so hard. And I understand why. I mean, I don't know the exact figure, but you know, they sort of say that 8 or 9 out of 10 businesses that are new co's don't make it past the first couple of years, normally because of cash flow.
Yeah.
But then when you actually get it moving and you get that momentum, you know, here we are 13 years in now. And as I was saying to you before we actually sat down in front of the mics, it's the first year where I've actually turned business away because I've just felt that, you know, it's not going to work. It's not going to be productive. Our time is better invested doing other routes, other options.
Yeah.
And that's a nice place to be in.
It is.
Random question I'm going to ask it to you. Do you believe in the afterlife?
Not especially. I'm open-minded about things, and I'm always interested to sort of listen to argument, but personally, I kind of don't see that as a viable or kind of likely thing. I certainly don't live by the idea that I've got something else to look forward to afterwards. If I'm going to get something done, I'm going to do it in the time I've got.
Good answer. So where do you guys call home?
Home is London for us, certainly for the foreseeable future. As I say, we love travelling. So it's been a sort of a joint passion of mine and Nicholas since we met. We spent a lot of our early years.
You've got an amazing story about your engagement.
Yes, yeah.
Do you want to share that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm very happy to. Yeah, so let's say that's part of that kind of early travelling. That was one of those things that as we kind of got together, Nicola was quite keen on spending sort of a block of time travelling. And at the time, that was a bit more difficult for me. So I was sort of, I was already kind of fairly involved in business. Right. Yeah, exactly. So the compromise was that basically every Christmas we'd take a slightly extended break because our industry is very quiet over Christmas. So yeah, the time we're talking about, we were travelling in Thailand and were sort of, I'd say, unfortunate enough to be caught up in the tsunami in 2004 or 2005, that sort of Boxing Day.
So you popped the question the night before the tsunami.
Yes.
You got enough of those really strong cocktails down Nick that she said yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the next morning, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that you then went to the internet cafe, because that's how long ago it was,
yep.
And you went to like email friends and family back home. And then, well, you go from there.
Yeah, I say that was really pretty accurate. So yeah, it was Christmas Eve that we actually got engaged. And I think I'd put so many of these cocktails down Nicola's neck that Christmas Day was kind of a write-off for us. We didn't really see much of Christmas Day. So Boxing Day got up, as you say, went to the internet cafe to kind of share the news with sort of some friends and family, and mid email, or I think we might have got the email off, we could hear sort of a commotion outside, and went sort of think, okay, what's happening there? But we carried on writing our email, and sort of suddenly the people that owned the internet cafe ran out of the internet cafe. So we thought, man, this is a bit strange. So being very English, we kind of stood around to kind of wait and pay. But before we knew it, there was kind of a fast-running river through the internet cafe of water, sort of up to ankle level. And so we knew something, and then something was sort of fairly...
And then the tsunami wave
literally then the wave. Well, we got out of the internet cafe, tried to head back to our hotel, because it was one of the only kind of brick-built structures on the island we were on.
How far away was that from the internet cafe directly?
It was a few hundred metres away. So we started to kind of head there, but was sort of wading through water. And then, as you say, that's when sort of the actual tsunami that was... as you'd have seen on like the news and that type of thing.
Yeah, horrific.
Yeah, came and hit. So we were washed in very different directions, and both.
And then it's like a movie scene. Like, my understanding, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were then both washed into the ocean. You were completely stripped of all of everything you had on.
Yeah.
You then got picked up by a fishing boat, did you?
Yeah, so I got washed into the sea, Nicola got trapped inland, and I pulled up onto a small kind of wooden fishing boat, basically. And in the end, I pulled up at the same time as a guy who was a dive instructor, climbed on the same boat.
Right.
So we filled that boat with as many people as we could, because obviously there were people in various states of kind of ill health or injury, and got them back onto... what was his dive boat, which was out on the
right,
a bit further out, so hadn't been sort of impacted by the wave as much. So they had sort of water on their medical supplies and that type of thing. So sort of dealing with that kind of initial mess that we were with, and sort of after that was dealt with, my attention turned to kind of where Nicola might be and how to sort of.
And she was trapped underneath some sort of corrugated...
Yeah, she'd been trapped under kind of... Yeah, there were a lot of those corrugated roofs, so they'd collapsed, and she was trapped on the island. But so that was unbeknown to me at that time. I didn't have an idea where she might be. So I was trying to work out whether to sort of try and get back onto the island, whether that was even possible. So, yeah, we were separated for a number of hours. And say, by complete miracle, boats started to kind of leave the island and try to get onto the type of boat we were on, with a view to kind of getting onto a bigger boat later and maybe get somewhere else. And by complete chance, Nicola ended up coming onto the boat that I was on. You know, it was a number of hours later, sort of 10 or so hours later. So yeah, we were incredibly lucky and relieved at that point. And obviously a lot of people weren't so lucky. That's kind of the big takeaway from it.
Such a traumatic experience. How often do you think about that?
I try not to think about it a lot. I think I tried to take the positives from it, isn't it? That you realise that, we were both fairly injured by that, and you know, you saw some things that you wouldn't want another person to see. But it makes you realise that, you know, a bit like we speak about a lot, you know, that life is fragile, and that, you know, that what you have can, you know, shouldn't be taken for granted. And I think that, yeah, that's the thing that I try to kind of extract from that situation, yeah. Is that, you know, that we're fortunate to be in the position we're in, and that things could have been very different. So yeah, I try not to think about it negatively. I think it's like, yeah, a lot of experiences you have to
take positive.
Try and take the positives, yeah, out of the experience.
Yeah. Mate, thanks for sharing that. It's an incredible story. I mean, it's literally a film script, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've asked you some of these already. Coming back to design, sort of favourite architect, it's probably difficult to narrow it down to one, but...
It is, because I think there's different types of architecture in the way that, you know, you can look at sort of big buildings and sort of starchitects type of thing, you know, sort of, you know, people that you'd have heard of, like Richard Rogers and John Paulson and people like that, sort of influenced, you know, a lot of that sort of modern, yeah, design, you know, sort of on a big scale. But a lot of the sort of individual, you know, smaller architects that we work with that do amazing houses and transform things and have visions of these sort of new build homes that you know, that I think it just it involves a huge amount of imagination and talent and making
that
work.
So it's evolved in the last, you sort of referred to it earlier on, in the last 10 or 15 years, just how much that talent and that sort of skill set has just, you know,
yeah,
become, yeah, and it's, you know, it's ever evolving, right, as everybody expects more and more and more from
them. Yeah, so I think that's the thing that we share, is that, you know, that passion for looking at a property, whether it's an older one or a new one, and seeing how somebody's sort of envisioned this thing and made it work, whether it's sort of, you know, the refurbishment of an old house or a new building, you know, that you look at it and it's sort of, you know, I think both of us get quite excited about, you know, about that, and sort of the power of that sort of improvement process, you know. So again, yeah, we've been very lucky to work with some really good, say sort of smaller boutique architects. Well, they run a team of sort of four or five people, so they're not people that everyone would have heard of, but yeah, you know, they do.
And they probably cut their teeth right, the big guys, and then probably branched off on their own, a lot of these,
yes,
independent guys,
exactly,
and girls.
That, yeah, I think.
Yeah. And yeah, so, I won't put you on the spot without your name, because obviously a lot of them you apply, so you're, yeah, gonna just pick one.
No,
but there's some brilliant ones out there. What's been your best investment? Quite an open-ended question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think probably the first thing that kind of... Probably the first flat I bought...
The cocktails in Thailand.
Yeah, the cocktails in Thailand. Yeah, that would be a very good long-term investment. I think sort of getting involved in property very young, I think we were probably the last generation of people.
We were so fortunate, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah, we were fortunate, yeah, enough to still kind of be able to just about...
My mates, Matty and Pete, that I live with at university, we rented on Nightingale Lane in Nightingale House. And when I said, oh, I'm moving out, guys, I'm buying a flat, they were like, what? We're like 22, what on earth are you doing buying a flat? But obviously because I've been an estate agent for, in fact, I've probably been about 23 or 24, but I'd saved up my 5% deposit,
yeah,
which I think was like £12,000.
Yeah.
And then obviously bought the flat, you know, in the building that you bought.
Yeah, fairly similar story. So again, I think I bought and sold a couple of flats before that flat, just as investments. So again, I think I was probably not much older than 19 when I bought my first... first flat. But again, it was very much in those days where it was sort of anything from a sort of 3 to 5% deposit. And so again, I think when you look at some of the situations that people, you know, in their sort of 20s or maybe 30s now,
yeah,
are in.
So George, who I work with in my office, George and his wife Katie and their lovely son Felix, who's just turned one, they've bought their flat, their first flat, they've just exchanged, they're due to complete next month in Worcester Park. You know, it's challenging for them. They had to save up, you know, a bigger deposit,
yep,
and obviously interest rates have gone up. And he's a brilliant estate agent, and Katie works for the NHS,
yep,
in palliative care. You know, so they're earning well, but at the same time, they probably couldn't afford to, you know, go and buy a Baltorp kitchen. And obviously, why would you do that when you're, you know, unless you're living in a sort of multi-million pound residential unit? What advice would you give to somebody that's at that stage in their life? Where would you go and buy a kitchen and a bathroom if you were a first-time buyer and, you know, you had a modest budget?
I think there's a number of ways. Again, I think the more creative you are, the better chance you've got,
right,
of succeeding that. So you sort of touched on it earlier with the flat that we had in Nightingale Lane. Actually, none of the things, or very few of the things that we put in there were expensive. They were kind of repurposed, or even the kitchen that we had there, actually, we didn't have the money to change the whole thing, so we changed some doors on it. Right. We put worktops on it that were, would have been expensive if we'd bought them just as a sort of from a stone company where we just come in and ask them to measure, but we went and found, you know, bits of offcuts that we could use from sort of suppliers that we'd got. I think it's about being creative about what it is you're trying to achieve, and also thinking quite carefully about what the purpose of what you're doing is. So are you doing something that you're intending to live there for sort of, you know, 5 to 10 years, or are you looking at something that you're going to improve a little bit, and, you know, in a couple of years you might move on. So I think, you know, it's about the length of investment, and really kind of sort of thinking through what the rationale behind what the improvements you're looking to make are. I think a lot of people just make changes for the sake of it without really thinking about sort of longevity, whether that's a good investment of time and money. You know, I think it's really kind of thinking through that process before you just embark on changing things.
Yeah, good answer. Staying in the kitchen for a minute, you're mm-hmm. a brilliant host and a brilliant cook. If you were on death row, what would your last meal be?
I would say, you know, there's some meals that kind of stick in your mind. And there's a restaurant we go to when we go to Italy that's owned by one of the guys that I work with's brother. So it's a fantastic fish restaurant. And whenever you go there, so it's talking about sort of hospitality and, you know, memories, I think it would probably be a meal there. So the fish comes straight out of the sea.
Which area of Italy?
So it's just outside of Venice. So it's an area called Caole, which is a very old town, but it's a fishing village effectively. Okay. So they have a restaurant there, and yeah, say if you have sort of the scallops there and that type of thing, you'll definitely go back. Yeah. So again, I think that would probably be a visit to Caole if I was like one more meal.
If you could relive the 80s, 90s, or noughties, which decade would you choose?
Probably the noughties when I met you.
Yes, good answer. favourite nightclub or venue from back in the day? You're a Londoner, aren't you?
I am a Londoner. It's like
not many of you in London.
No, it's exactly. Like, no.
It's quite rare to meet a Londoner.
I'd say my favourite venue probably isn't in London, though. My favourite sort Unidance. Of memory of kind of nightclubbing or sort of going out is probably Space in Ibiza.
Yes.
So again, I've had a couple of good nights there.
Yeah, well, as have I.
Yeah. So I'd say that again. I didn't used to spend an awful lot of time clubbing in London. When we're here, we've sort of been more bars, going out for dinner, that right. type of thing. But yeah, so I've yeah, certainly had some
banging, wasn't it, back in the day?
Yeah, great nights there.
Favorite part of London?
Probably at the moment, I love Marylebone. If I was going to live somewhere else in London, as the kids
go, we both live around Waltham Common at the moment.
Yeah, we live around. Yeah. I love where we live. I mean, it's great for what I need at the moment. It's lots of green space. You know, it's
works for the kids' schools.
Works for the kids' schools, yeah. Absolutely. But if I was going to spend less time in London but enjoy it while I was there, I'd say I'd lay my hat in Marylebone.
That's it. Brilliant. Thank you. If people want to find you on, or Design Space on social media, how can they find you?
So we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, all of the sort of normal platforms.
Or Design Space London.
Go to designspacelondon.com. Yeah. It's our website. You'll find us there. Or come in and see us at Wigmore Street.
Yeah, brilliant.
There.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Attended Exchange, a Wilford Property podcast, now streaming on all platforms.